Hello, my name is May.
And my name is Clinton.
Welcome to Horrorspiria.
Ooh.
This podcast will be an analysis of the horror genre and its movements within the international lens. We were both born and raised on the mainland United States for the most part, and the fear that comes out from this part of the world shares a lot with other outputs internationally. So sometimes we're influencers, sometimes we're the influenced. And so we decided, how do these different movements differ? How do these different films differ from region, country, time periods? Horror is known as an unabated continuum that links past anxieties to future and present social anxieties. And so, what happens when we look at our own culture between the lens of the international community and the international films through the lens of the American eye? But first, a little bit more about us. Like I said, my name is May. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico and in Florida, and I moved to DC a couple of months ago. I am a film and horror academic at George Mason University. Shout out to my students. Some of them might hear this. And yeah, Clinton, tell us about you.
Okay, so my name is Clinton. I was born in California, but raised on the East Coast. And I am new to international horror. I have not the qualifications of May, who is a wonderful, wonderful teacher, as you will find out.
He's saying that because we met because I was his Spanish teacher. And don't get excited, guys, all right? It was an extracurricular thing. He's older than me, all right? No,
Oh,
no predatory,
very old. Yeah.
no age disclosures here. But yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not coming in with the knowledge. I'm going to be learning with the listener. But I do love horror movies. And I think my biggest qualification is that I have a tattoo of Teen Wolf on my
Wait,
body.
what?
Yeah, you knew that,
You
right?
no, you. How dare you? Do,
You were pretty much you were pretty into Pokemon Go at the time I told you, but I definitely have told you before.
Oh my God. Wait, so like 1980s Teen Wolf?
Yeah, I mean it's a
Okay.
reinterpretation, you know.
Okay.
Yeah,
All right.
the
Because
classic.
I know you maybe may not know this, but there's like a really popular MTV show.
Oh
So
yes.
for a second, I was
Okay.
like
Listener, I'm old, but I'm not that old. I know about Teen Wolf, the new one. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Before we get started, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing really good now. You know, it's stressful being single in
Oh
Washington,
God.
D.C., or really anywhere in the world, but I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to be talking about international horror.
All right. Well, Clinton,
Uh-huh.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, let's go.
What was the first foreign horror film you saw from your memory?
So I think, like a lot of folks, just grew up on Americana,
Right.
80s, 90s, Gremlin,
Gremlins,
Nightmare on Elm Street,
yeah, the
you know, all
classics.
those kind of things. So I really don't know what the first international horror movie was.
Really?
I am but a low simpleton who mostly consumes trash.
Okay, well, even as a teenager, did you ever like do you remember having like seeing something weird as a teenager or
Yes. I was into some real just like B movie stuff, you know?
Right.
So if it was weird, it was that kind of weird. It wasn't like,
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah. So like Roger Corman, things like
Exactly.
that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But you never had like, did you ever have like a phase?
An international phase.
Yeah.
I was into Jackie Chan movies. Okay. I had a
I feel like
whole.
every kid that was every, no, I'm sorry, every man, because this is specifically not to genderize Jackie Chan, because,
Thank you.
Jackie Chan, specifically, I've always met men who just like, idolize Jackie
Oh,
Chan.
really? Well, you
Yeah,
sound, I mean, it sounds like you've met some good people.
All right. All right. Okay. Well, that's fair. For me, I can't remember the first one, but I do know when it all started in a way. And it actually started with Blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
It was I don't remember how old I was, it was probably 1999 or 2000. So I guess I was like 10 or 11, actually. And The Ring had just come out and things like that. And I think I like traced that back. I was always like a really nerdy kid. So I was always one that was like always doing research. And when I found out it was a remake, I decided to uncover all of those films. Uh-huh. And as you know, The Ring, Ringu. So
that's right. That's about as far as my international knowledge goes. Ringu.
Yeah. Which we'll probably have a podcast on Japanese horror one day. But okay. I didn't love Ringu, but it was just the tone was so different that the first one that I remember being like the turning point for me was A Tale of Two Sisters. Did you ever see that one?
No.
Okay. It's a Korean film. It's from 2001, I want to say.
But A Tale of Two Sisters sounds pretty horrifying to me.
That was horrible. Listeners, I promise that will never happen
like
again.
A, you know, the sisters are like mad at each other
about something. Stop it. No.
I had a brother.
Like, this is not going the way. No, I'm kidding. No, yeah, A Tale of Two Sisters. And I just remember, I was, as like you, I was always really obsessed with horror films like Cujo and Nightmare on Elm. I was obsessed with Nightmare on Elm Street, The Exorcist. My happiest memories of my childhood were really based around going to Blockbuster and renting a horror film. And then I don't know if it was Blockbuster that did this or if it was just my own curiosity. They started to carry international horror films. And then instead of just renting, you know, like Stephen King movies, it became international films. So every few days, it was a different international horror film.
Yeah,
and that's really where it started for me. So it really started with like Asian horror. And then as I grew older and my scope grew larger, I got into other movements. And yeah, so that's really where the passion for this podcast is coming from.
From Blockbuster Video.
Yes.
Shout outs.
Honestly,
Brick
I don't.
And mortar. We'll take a promotion. We'll
yes.
take your money.
Please, you Blockbuster,
know?
Listen
Everyone
to us.
Go back in time and visit a
yes.
Blockbuster Video.
I know, especially because it's just not the same on Netflix. Like, it's just not. It's not. And I mean, I have like all of the streaming channels, but man, no, I really just miss Blockbuster. It would be a complete waste of time.
It was great just to look at boxes, you know, box art, and just walk around, like, you know, trying to figure out what you're going to do.
You know, literally. Yeah, no, it was honestly the worst thing in the world. And now this has become a podcast about Blockbuster. All right, so let's get back on track.
Okay.
Let's do a recap. So we're starting with German Expressionism. The reason why we're starting with German Expressionism is it really was one of the first film movements, period, and it was the premier first horror movement, and it also just happens to be, you know, international. So for everyone out here, let's go ahead and do a quick recap of German Expressionism so you kind of know what's going on before we get into the nitty-gritty.
I've got my paper and my pencil. I'm ready.
All right. Do you want to maybe, you think I can do this in 60 seconds?
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
All right. Okay. I'm going to try and do this in 60 seconds.
I'm going to pull that up on my phone here.
We're still gonna talk about it more, but I think this will be a challenge for me because I always know what I want to say, but then when I know that time is up, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Go.
All right. Okay, so German Expressionism started around the late 1910s and lasted until about 1933. And it was mainly a response from World War I and the Treaty of Versailles. You know, Germany was completely isolated from the rest of the world. Foreign films were banned in Germany because of this. And so German films were having really large popularity. And so all of the directors, producers, writers from this movement were either in the war or affected directly by the aftermath. And so trepidation and malaise were really rampant. And so a lot of this fear and depression and this feeling of nothingness manifested into expressionism. And it went through all of the visual mediums. So it was an art movement, it was a film movement, it was a literary movement, and they all kind of informed each other. And so the main thing about this is they wanted to know, how did the mental become visual? And that was really the challenge of it.
Boom. Okay. That was 59 seconds.
What?
And there was like a half second there between the time my brain, you know,
stopping
registered
it.
And then I pushed the button. Yes,
okay.
All right.
That's fair. I like it. All right. Okay. So German Expressionism. Do you know anything about
Well, yeah, you know, to prepare for this podcast, I watched a couple movies that you sent me.
Right.
Yeah. and I know what you've just said.
Okay.
Those words. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So that's what you know.
Yeah.
So, hey, you guys are on par with him. All right. Okay. Well, do you know about World War One in general?
Honestly, not a lot.
Okay. Well, you know, the Treaty of Versailles. Basically, Germany couldn't do much just within its borders, okay, which became known as the Weimar Republic.
Weimar. Okay.
The Weimar Republic. Yeah.
Okay.
Weimar. Yes.
Okay. Weimar.
Yeah. And the W's are all V's. In general, it was a rejection of Western conventions because they weren't allowed foreign films from other areas. They really just had each other to rely on.
And was that because of their own government? Or,
yeah. So it wasn't like they were necessarily super loyal to the government. A rebellion was definitely a lot of the impetus for them making these films. But they still sometimes had to seek funding from the government or anything. So it definitely, you know, it was a bit of a line to tread. But they didn't censor themselves. It was more how could they completely exaggerate all of their depression, all of this fear, mm-hmm, into something horrifying, because they were feeling horrified just to exist every now and then. Like their main thing is that they wanted the reaction. They wanted to shock. They wanted to be known for these grotesque realities. And so it was really more, how could they do this? Because we have to also remember, this was 1920. Film industries were very nascent.
Right. There was hardly a blockbuster to be found.
No, it was like a blockbuster. I think I just made them French. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's like Romania. No, okay,
I know.
Say it for the Vampire
I'm
podcast.
Trash, sorry.
Okay, no, but yeah, they were isolated. And so they only had each other as artists to rely on. And so that's really where this all started.
So was it similar to like parody where you can get away with critiquing the social moment a little bit better because you're abstracting a little bit or you're making it scary? Like, is that part of it, or is it not so much critical of social?
That's a good
political
question.
Stuff going on there.
It wasn't, and we'll see this when we talk about how the movement ended. It wasn't really like they would get jailed or anything for it. It was more like they wanted to make art, and it was how far could they push these films from reality while also being an outlet for their reality? What
gotcha.
Is the difference between? And that's why a lot of these films have very fantastical settings, but they also have very specific German relationships and German texts,
okay,
you know, and it definitely, it's not like these films could have been made anywhere. These films influenced a whole bunch of people, and we'll go ahead and talk about them, but the films themselves, there were only less than 30 made,
okay,
over the, so it was mainly the 20s, because a lot of them started production in 1918, 1919, and then they began to be released in 1920, and then they had to flee in 1933 for reasons we can maybe guess about. We'll definitely talk about that.
I have no idea. I know nothing.
You know nothing? Okay.
What happened after World War One? I don't
what
know.
What happened? No.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good.
Okay. We'll both find out, listening.
So one thing I do want to mention is that there was no manifesto written for the German Expressionists, which I don't know if maybe you might know this, but usually film movements that followed, like Third Cinema or the French New Wave, they all kind of had like this rule book, like you're not making a French New Wave film if you're not doing this, this, or this, or you're not making Third Cinema film if you're not doing this, this, or this. German Expressionism and the directors, the producers, the writers, they were all just like this group of like friends for the most part. They all, you know, they all worked on each other's films and everything. There was definitely competition and things like that.
Mm.
But there was no like manifesto. It was more like, we're just making art because we don't know what else to do.
Gotcha.
You know?
Quick question.
Yeah.
Was it all men?
That's actually a very great question. For the most part, all of the directors were men, mm-hmm, but some of the writers and some of the producers were actually women. A lot of the literature was very women-driven. So
okay,
a lot of the German Expressionist literature was very women-driven. Most of the painters were men as well, but it was kind of like everyone. I will say a lot of the women were married to directors and things like that. But for the most part, you know, I'm sure The difficult thing about a lot of the research from this time, even from some of the most well-known things like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and things like that, they were, the histories are so disputed. So, like, the producers say this thing happened, but it contradicts what the directors say, contradicts what the writers say. And they're just really, a lot of these films were trying to be destroyed by Nazi Germany as well. And a lot of these films, as we'll talk about in the case of Nosferatu, this is, again, a very nascent industry. They weren't looking for film rights or anything like that. So a lot of the films sometimes were destroyed as parts of lawsuits. There were three main things that these directors and writers were trying to express because of their society. They were trying to express disillusionment with the German government, with the German atmosphere, you know, the disillusionment that there's no future for them there. Okay. They wanted to express distrust of authority, especially, like I said, a lot of them were in the war. A lot of them had to cheat to get out of the war. Like, some of them make up illnesses, make up madnesses, and they would just see how the war took away their families and their friends. And so there was a big distrust of anyone with authority.
Okay.
And the third thing was the isolation. They were completely isolated from most of the world. They weren't taking in art from other nations. So it was really like, what could they do? How could they express these things?
So if they had a manifesto, that might be it.
In a way. Also, there's...
It's scary.
Yeah, it's scary and it's dark and we don't know what to do. Yeah, no, yeah, really. That was a really big thing. And then there was a really big theme. Based on the films that I made you watch, could you take a guess at what is the overarching theme?
The overarching theme, huh? Well, as a modern viewer, I took a lot away from them from like a technical standpoint.
Right.
Like, the lack of sound and I've never seen a black and white movie before where they color it. So it's like different colors, different scenes.
Yes, that was super popular. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was very taken aback by that. Mm-hmm. And you know, the versions you can watch now on YouTube, like, people put different music to it.
Yeah, they
and
do.
And some of it's really bad. And then I think I'm listening to something bad. And then the next movie I watch, it's even worse, and I'm just like, wow. So, but if I go back to a theme, a common theme, it's like, I like isolation, darkness. I did see a lot of, some Jewish representation, and I wasn't sure if it was anti-Semitic or if it was,
you know,
so.
Some of it that you saw, like Gollum especially. Right. Yeah.
Is Gollum anti-Semitic or is
I think
just...
Gollum is pretty anti-Semitic.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like,
I think.
It's like, spoiler alert, Jewish people might have a monster in their temple.
Yeah, by the way, there's going to be a lot of spoilers here. So
yeah, spoilers.
Prepare yourself. Definitely I think Gollum was anti-Semitic, yeah.
Okay.
Or was it
just representation? And I haven't seen, because that's another thing, is I don't even see a lot of, it made me really realize how few religions other than like Catholicism I see in a horror
context.
I mean,
there definitely wasn't like woke culture back then.
Woke culture was very weak.
Very weak. I mean, we can kind of guess because of what happened next,
that's
maybe.
That's true.
But, you know, I will say all of them.
I don't know what happens next, as we've established, go on.
All of them did have to become exiled because of World War II and the Nazi Party rising.
Yeah.
So definitely, we can definitely look at it a lens through that. Definitely Gollum, like I said, is anti-Semitic. But like, you know what's funny? I just rewatched Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde the other day. This is not German. This is a pre-code American horror film. And man, oh man, the racial overtones to that, I don't think it was necessarily... I don't know. I think it was on purpose, to the extent that that kind of racism was so ingrained that they were like, oh, yes, he's crazy. We must do all of, you know, how do we make him crazy? Let's make him look like this. It's a film for what it is. It was made in 1932, but it doesn't mean that we should ignore why they thought of that. And I think it's the same when we look at films like Gollum, you know, that really, if we just talk about it frankly, it is pretty much like anti-Semitic propaganda. You know, they have this giant monster that's killing
everyone. Looks like Trump, by the way. It's really, I tried not to think it. At first time I thought it, I was like, Nah, it doesn't look that much like Trump. But when you watch the whole movie, this Emmer Effer looks and moves like Trump. He's a big effing golem.
Yeah. And actually,
even though, but I would say the golem, you know, is kind of a good guy in the movie.
Yeah, right? He's definitely, he is definitely kind of like.
Trump is not a good guy.
Yeah, we are not one of those podcasts.
Golem
plays.
Is better. Golem for president.
Yes. You know what's actually funny about Golem? Golem was.
His haircut.
Yeah, sure. But Golem, that dude actually made 7 golems. It was like,
what?
Yeah.
I would watch another golem.
They were all destroyed except the one that you saw.
Wow.
So there we go. Wow. More proof of just how fragile this history is.
They're actually remaking Golem. Or I don't know about remaking. There's a new movie coming out called
really?
Golem. Yeah.
Oh, I don't. I mean,
I will watch the trailer at some point.
I mean, isn't there like a more, isn't like Golem also like a Lord of the Rings
That's
thing?
That's true. There are several Golems.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. But I'm sure our Golem was probably, okay.
But I do, okay, so here, I got us off track here. What is the theme?
Thank you. Great student.
Thank you.
The overarching theme is madness and identity. And as we go through the films that we'll talk about, you'll kind of see how madness and identity is tied through all of them. So there are 5 major things that make a German expressionist film.
Okay.
And I guess you could call it a manifesto if there is one. But
there isn't one. We've established that.
There isn't one, no. But generally, you're watching a German expressionist film if it was made in Germany between 1919 and 1933, and if these 5 things are present in the film. The first is deep shadows. And so they, to enhance the effect of deep shadows, because they didn't have LEDs back then or anything, they would literally paint the shadows on the set. So you.
What?
Yeah, literally.
That's wild.
So, you know, you might remember if you saw The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, that one for me is always the one that sticks out the most with contrast. They literally just painted those shadows because they couldn't really achieve it otherwise.
Weird. Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. The second thing is exaggerated angles.
Okay. Such as?
When we're like descending watchtowers or anything, it would never be straight movements. It would always be really, really high.
Angular or?
Well, angular, yeah. Yeah. Just things that we couldn't see through a normal eye, you know, normally. So they would purposely, and this one ties into the third one, which is impossible architecture. They would build in holes in the wall that way you could put the camera through, that way it would make some things look lopsided and defy gravity, but really it's because the camera was set at a certain angle. Because again, like I said, it was about exaggerating their fear and their reality as much as possible. Did you get that through some of the films that you saw? Like, do you remember some of the set design?
I remember the set design in the sense that I remember thinking, oh, this looks kind of like a theater play or something.
Right.
Because I'm not used to seeing any, like a door that's not just a door, or a house that's
right,
not just
right,
a,
right,
a
right,
giant
right,
real
right.
house.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
And it looked like there was a lot of like art and creativity
yeah.
that you can put in if you just like go for it.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I mean, you actually brought up a great point. A lot of them before film, because film wasn't really a thing,
yeah.
they started out in theater. You know, a lot of these directors were failed actors, failed directors for the stage. And they were like, well, I guess let me try this film thing and see how it works.
Yeah.
Like Caligari, like I said, which is pretty much like the penultimate German expressionist film. Like if we were to choose the crown jewel.
Which one?
The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I think that one and Metropolis are the 2 most iconic.
Those stand out.
Yeah, those are the standouts. And it's funny because they kind of bookend each other. Caligari was one of the first ones, and then Metropolis was one of the last ones made.
Okay.
So, yes, exaggerated angles, impossible architecture, impossible set design, highly stylized acting, which I think you got a lot of that. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
like when they go mad. They go mad.
Yeah, they really
he's
do.
He's like, his hair is frizzing out. He's jumping all over the place.
Yeah,
he's going crazy.
Yeah. It's pretty much Tom Cruise, Oprah.
Yes.
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 That might be too old of a reference.
That
was
my first international horror film. It wasn't international.
Wait,
it wasn't international.
Not even. Oh, wait, no. It was Penelope Cruz, right?
He was
in love with?
Oh, jeez.
I think it was.
Wasn't Nicole Kidman?
Oh, no. It was Katie Holmes. Wait, it was Penelope Cruz or Katie Holmes?
Was he in love with Penelope Cruz?
They dated during Vanilla Sky.
Oh, okay.
Okay, someone please fact check this. We're gonna have a
Shout
website.
Out
We're
to
gonna
Penelope Cruz. She's not got a new movie coming out. It also looks good.
Yes, it's foreign. Asghar Farhad. Farhad. Oh my god, my
wow.
best friend.
Wow, that's my Spanish teacher, everybody.
My best friend's gonna kill me for trying to butcher that because he's Iranian. I'm sorry,
oh, it's
Delia.
Iranian.
He's an Iranian. I told you this. He's an Iranian. Okay.
Oh,
everybody.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Javier.
No, I was saying the dude.
Oh, I'm a bad student.
You horrible. We saw that trailer together.
We did.
Too.
That's why we're both. That's why we both know about.
This is why this is the worst podcast you'll ever listen to. Okay, and the last one, the last thing. So we went through
okay.
four.
Yeah.
The last thing, dark story themes. So
oh yeah.
Very dark. Mm-hmm. You know, not a lot of happy endings here.
No.
No. That's pretty much that. That's a good summary over the movement.
Can we go over what movies? What are some of the classics?
So some of the classics. So
Metropolitus. You mentioned the Isle of Dr. Calamari.
Yeah. You're like combining. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I see what I did there, and I don't.
No,
like it.
No.
It's Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Caligari. Yes, we're now Italian. Nosferatu.
Oh, okay.
Metropolis.
Where does Nosferatu fit in all this? Because it's, I feel like it has an impact where it's still being referenced today. Was it a bigger movie than some of these other ones, or was it kind of all on the same level as?
Nosferatu probably has the most interesting history tied to it, so
Ooh,
we'll get to it.
Okay.
But Nosferatu was created because of this film, and I'll explain why.
Of what film?
Because of the German film.
Okay.
Yeah, yes, and I'll explain why. We have From Morn to Midnight, The Golem, of course, and yeah, so there were quite a few. There were less than 30 made, but they were all rather popular because, again, Germany was isolated. These films were... had a really great social impact in a sense, you know.
Okay.
they definitely weren't like under the radar. They definitely were trendsetters globally.
Uh-huh.
And we'll see how some of the people influenced by German Expressionism, by the way, we'll get into the specifics towards the end, but I mean, we see German Expressionism even now. Werner Herzog made a remake of Nosferatu in the 70s. Generally, if you ever see Nosferatu reference, it's because of this German film. Nosferatu didn't exist before this German film. And I'll explain why. Mm-hmm. Tim Burton, obviously. Edward Scissorhands straight up is, you could almost count that as a German Expressionist film. Because his house, the shadows and everything. Burton himself said that like he specifically sourced Caligari for most of it. Alfred Hitchcock was actually right around that time. And he made a film actually in the 20s after seeing some of the German Expressionist films. So, you know, he was directly influenced as well. And I mean, of course,
I've got one more to add.
Yes.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Do
you know what I'm talking about that?
No, I don't. I've never seen SpongeBob
wow,
SquarePants.
Wow, who's old? What? Oh yeah. My gosh. Well, if you try to watch Nosferatu on YouTube, you will see, and you go to the comments section, you will see 100 comments about SpongeBob and are you here because of SpongeBob? And then a bunch of people click like, and then you get the like the direct link to the exact moment that's referenced in SpongeBob. So yeah, it still lives today.
I am so glad for that. Thank you for being the SpongeBob
academic. Oh yeah, I got your back here.
I was going to say, I got into German Expressionism, I think around the same time, if not a little bit before, Japanese horror films, because they were referenced in like the music videos of all of the bands I really loved when I was like 13. They had a gothic foundation, so in general, anything that's gothic based, even afterward, is going to kind of trace back. But these films, for as small, the small industry that it was, it really has resonated over and over and over throughout the years, like on SpongeBob.
Yeah, it's resonating, folks.
It's resonating. Okay, all right. So are you ready to get started about our first film?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we're going to start with The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Thank you.
Wow, that was a good score.
Indeed it was. And now we have my cat trying to drink Clinton's tea. Mm. All right.
A black cat on theme. Just wanted to let everyone know.
I'm always on theme.
Okay.
Anyways, yes, that was the score from a piece of the original score from the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is often considered the very first German expressionist and German horror film. It was in production through most of 1919, and it was directed by Robert Wien. Robert Wien. Yeah. And it was released in 1920. And it's about an insane hypnotist who uses a somnambulist to commit murders. So pretty crazy stuff. What did you think of the film just generally? Oh,
so, well, this was a shocker because the version I watched had no sounds.
Right.
And I was like, did they made movies without sound? Like, like not even...
Was it your very first silent film?
Well, I'm used to silent films being like 10 minutes or 5 minutes or something. So this was a shocker. So at first I thought, wow, should I like just put on my own music, you know? And then for a while I was repeating one of the Weeknd's songs.
Oh my God.
Because he has, all his songs are kind of low-key spooky.
No, yeah. He's definitely like horror pop. But then pop.
I just started enjoying it.
You started enjoying it?
I started enjoying it.
Yeah. I want to watch that cut. I'm going to just...
The Weeknd cut?
Yeah, I'm just going to put the hills, the hills on the loop, just right underneath it.
Same.
Oh my God, wow.
Right?
Great idea.
So I, you know, I got attention deficit a little bit like everybody else, although not, you know, I'm sure not to downplay just, people's real
me,
attention
deficit. Excuse me, I do not get attention deficit with Caligari, okay? It's a perfect film.
Yeah, okay. So don't watch any old movie with your phone near you because you will get distracted.
Yeah, what are you doing, dude? These are films, you have to, it's like they saw it in a black box.
Right.
They freaked out when trains were going at them, okay?
Exactly.
You have to recreate the mood.
Right, you're right.
It's
you're
actually
absolutely right.
Definitely on my bucket list items. They do a lot of. I haven't really looked into them into DC area, but it's probably really popular around here. They do like silent films with live orchestras, dude. It's one of my like top
I'd be down
things.
For that.
Yeah, we need to figure it out.
We should do that.
Hello, if someone knows when this is happening in the DC area, please add us on Twitter or something. We're social.
We're okay. Recording our first episode, and we're already gonna do a live show.
What? We're doing decided. A live show?
At the symphony.
We're not. No, we're not.
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
Okay, back on track.
Yes, back on track.
So, can I jump right to the ending?
No, let's give some context first. So, this was written by Hans Janowitz and Karl Mayer. I know I nailed those, so good. Mr. Janowitz was actually a German officer during the war, and Mayer feigned madness to get out of fighting in
Dang.
The war. And then the kind of ironic part about both of this is that they were both leaders of a pacifist movement at the time.
Really?
Yeah. So a lot of conflicting emotions going on there, especially because, like I said, conflicting stories.
Uh-huh.
Some of them said that this is a political film. Some of them said that this is a very not political film.
Okay.
And I think it could be read either way. But yes, either way, Caligari is modeled after Mayer's psychiatrist, who is the dude that helped him feign the madness.
Really?
Yeah. And so Caligari, for those that didn't watch it, he's the insane hypnotist. He's the one that's pulling the puppet strings on the somnambulist. So it's kind of interesting to know that.
Can we do a quick plot synopsis for those that didn't see it and also those who did see it but were distracted?
Sure, yeah. So like I said, an insane hypnotist, somnambulist, but what's the twist?
Somnambulist?
Yeah.
What's a somnambulist?
It's one of those, a sleepwalker kind of thing.
Sleepwalker.
It's one of those things where I know that somnambulists existed back then, but I don't think there is a somnambulist now.
Okay.
Yeah,
it was like
one
of those like
it's a sleepwalker.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not like a profession or anything.
Okay.
So I don't know, if you sleepwalker or somnambulist.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean
but
I dabble.
For some reason I always feel like they use that term
I'm
like
some somnambulist.
You do sleepwalk?
Sometimes.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah. Well, you know.
We're never hanging out overnight now.
Okay. We were hanging out a lot overnight before, ladies and gentlemen. No. That's a joke.
Oh my God.
Okay, so
Jesus.
But so what is the
but
what does he do?
What's the twist? Well, I mean, he kills a bunch of people, remember? So, yeah. So, I mean, so Caligari is, so the sonnambulist, his name is Cesare. I do know that that's right. Cesare. And so Cesare is off killing a bunch of people in this, like, kind of circus kind of thing. Because they're, like a traveling roadshow kind of thing. Which, by the way, all of the settings in this movie are based in real life. So, so Genovitz and Mayer, they were, like, best friends. And they went to the Kantstrasse in Berlin, which was a traveling road show, and they were like, oh my god, this is where our movie's gonna take place. And the town that it takes place in is the town that they lived in and everything. So everything setting wise is actually lifted from real life, which again feeds into the whole how are we going to distort
reality. Yeah.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. But you know the twist. What's actually the twist of the film?
This is like when you get called on in class and you didn't really do your homework as well as you should have.
All right. Okay, shut up. The twist.
It's a silent movie, ladies and gentlemen. And
okay, shut.
Silence is also a really good environment for falling asleep. But I woke back up at a really cool moment. But go ahead. I'm curious. What was the twist?
Well, for everyone, including Clinton, the twist is that none of it is real. This is all a dream inside one of the side characters. So the side character existed throughout the film, but he was kind of like a secondary character. But then they kind of descend into madness, and then he wakes up in an insane asylum. So the last 10 minutes is them in the insane asylum. In the movie previous, are in this insane asylum, but they're different people.
Whoa.
So Cesare, the dude that's been killing everyone, he's just another kind of like inmate, if you want to say, in the asylum. The dude that's been dreaming all of it, he had a fiance in the asylum.
Okay.
She's also another patient in the asylum. And then Caligari himself is actually the head of the asylum, but he's not really. I mean, this is where it gets open to interpretation, because even the writers didn't agree whether it was political or not.
Uh-huh.
And then the film itself, you can read a political stance into it, or you can just also go the safer route. Oh, the madness is all in this dude's head. The dude is the one that's crazy.
Gotcha.
You know? So that's a synopsis of it.
Because, yeah, I woke up and all of a sudden he was like, money is bullshit, and he was like throwing money everywhere, and I was like, wow. I was like, I did not expect it to go here, and I love it. Yeah, and it really made me think, like, this is some cool shit, you know?
Right. I mean, this is a direct quote from one of the writers.
Okay.
Specifically Janowitz, who was the one in the war.
Okay.
He said that the film was a commentary on the authoritative power of the inhumane state gone mad. So you can say Caligari, especially because he's symbolic of the psychiatrist, the war psychiatrist. Caligari is representative of the state, and then all of the inmates are and the effect of the state, which again translates into the malaise, translates into the isolation, translates into the general hopelessness that they feel, right?
Yeah. What was the what was that part?
That
just a flourish?
That's you not watching the film.
God damn it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So
did they ever find out what was in the cabinet? Like some, you know, medicine stuff? Cesare was in the cabinet?
Yeah, dude. Did you not even see that?
There was Cesare was the character.
Yeah, but whenever they did the circus thing, he would open the cabinet.
That was the cabinet. Okay, oh okay, gotcha. I was thinking more of like a medicine cabinet.
I should throw you off a cliff. That was just, it should happen. The way that it was shot in general was pretty standard of the time. These two dudes wrote the script. They found a producer from one of the German studios. The German studio found the director. And they shot it all in the studio. Most of the expressionist films were always shot in studios. And yeah, what do you think in general, like...
I thought it kicked ass.
Yeah, no, and I mean,
I would watch it again.
What do you think it really? What is your interpretation?
Well, let me throw that question right back at you, because I admittedly didn't watch enough to make a really.
I mean, I actually do think it's more of a political stance than anything else. Yeah. Robert Veen, the director, he was exiled in the 30s.
They didn't love him.
But
or
on
did
that
he
note.
Himself?
He exiled himself,
okay.
But he never explicitly ever said any anti-Nazi kind of things, whereas the other two directors that we're going to talk about did. And he was exiled in Belgium, not America.
Okay.
So he stayed in Belgium for the rest of his life. He didn't really make films after that. He was actually, he's an example of a failed theater dude going into something else. This time it was film.
Yeah.
So it was, it's all just very interesting. I definitely think this film is something where it's the sum of all of its parts. Whereas I do think there are some other examples that are very director-driven or very specifically driven by one thing. I definitely think that this one probably works the most because the set designer had a strong vision, the director had a strong vision, the writers had a very strong vision. It all just really worked together to really make the statement of what German expressionism was.
Yeah. I felt that too. Everybody, you should go check it out if you haven't seen it. It is definitely worth watching. Even though it's, you know, got the pacing of an older movie.
It's really not that bad.
It's not only that bad. Like, didn't have the...
It's only an hour.
It's only... Well, yeah, I think it's a little bit more than an hour.
It's like 70 minutes tops, bro.
Okay. And we'll like... check that runtime, but you know...
Metropolis is 3 hours, okay?
Metropolis is a long movie.
All right. Let's get to Nosferatu, shall
we? A couple naps in a Metropolis.
You are horrible. Don't take any naps during any of these films. Okay, All right. Okay. Let's look at Nosferatu.
All right.
The score, some of the original score for Nosferatu. What do you know about Nosferatu in general? SpongeBob SquarePants?
Well, so generally, I know that there is some influence, like we talked about earlier, SpongeBob and that kind of thing. And I think the movie Shadows, What We Do in the Shadows.
What We Do in the Shadows,
What
right?
We Do in the Shadows. There's a character that's based on
so when Peter, I was right the old one the
yeah
really old one
yeah. yes so yeah. When I was watching this, I thought, okay, this is definitely, you know, this is still around.
No, I mean, I laugh, but it's true, because I mean, especially when we look at these older films, we see them through the lens of everything that's come before. And I think when you really understand that and when you really pull that back, you're able to be like, oh my god, like, wow, this really was like what started it.
Yeah.
But Nosferatu is very different and very specific for reasons I'll get into. So first off, do you know what Nosferatu is about in general?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to try?
No.
Okay. Let's
pause so the listener can say at this moment, they can fill in.
No.
That was good. Good one. You know what you're talking about. Okay.
Well, no. I mean... And you can just take a guess, because I know that, like, is it an adaptation? Is it this? What do you think Nosferatu is?
I think it's probably an adaptation from, like, an original Dracula story.
Okay. Do you mean that they adapted Dracula or they adapted Nosferatu?
They adapted. I don't know what I mean.
Okay, it's an interesting distinction.
Okay.
Because Nosferatu didn't exist before this.
Okay.
This is an adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Okay.
But the really interesting thing about that is, again, this was back in a time where, like, film rights, you had to get film rights to novels.
Okay.
But a lot of studios try to get around it because no one really knew how far this film thing was going to go. And so this is kind of what happened in the case of Nosferatu. So Nosferatu was made in 1922. It's directed by F.W. Murnau, who who's one of the most well-known silent film directors of all time. After the Nazis took over, he fled to America, and he made Sunrise, which is considered the greatest silent film of all time. It's my favorite silent film of all time, I'm pretty sure. Maybe Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is up there, but Sunrise, I remember I saw that film in film school. And there's very rarely films that anyone sees in film school that they're like, oh, okay. But man, Sunrise was it for that me. It really was. Yeah, I love F.W. Murnau. He's definitely one of my favorites. But the whole concept of Nosferatu actually came from a producer for a very young German studio. And so this was going to be their first film. And this producer, his name is Alban Grau. He was in the war. And when he was in the war, he was in Serbia. And in Serbia, they had this vampire folklore. And the dude was like, ah, you know what? This would be an excellent film. I want to make a vampire film. And the most recognizable vampire was?
Dracula.
Dracula. Dracula. Yeah, so Dracula was the most popular one. But again, he was a first-time producer. This was a young studio. And so what they did, the studio itself was called Prana Film, for anyone that wants to know.
Prana Film.
And it's actually named after the Hindu belief of prana. Oh. So kind of interesting, yeah. So it's technically like Hindu-based or whatever. He found a writer, a for-hire writer. His name is Henrik Galin. And so he told him to adapt Dracula. Henrik Galin also wrote Gollum.
Oh, nice. That's right there.
So this is a dude that, you know, was going...
Did he probably wrote Gollums 2-7 also?
You know, I'm pretty sure that information was burned up with the... Damn! Actually, Gollum is the last one. The one that you saw is the last one.
Okay. Really?
Yeah, so you're actually seeing like Gollum 7.
Oh, God. That was the last one. I wonder if they like rebooted at some point, because that was like pretty much an origin story.
It was the prequel. I remember that.
It was the prequel.
So they made the prequel last.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Listen, if you're out there listening and you know you have like a secret copy of Gollums 2-7.
First off, they could go for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Pretend you didn't hear that. Hit us up. Hit me up on Twitter. At Clinto Peel. Okay, that's Clinto P-E-E-L. Anyways,
you know, back to the show, but Clinton, I'm really desperate to see some Gollums. Because he is trying to gentrify film history. I mean, could you gentrify film history? No. What kind of white are you again?
Oh, I'm boring white. I can't even like lay claim to one nationality proudly.
Okay,
which is probably good.
Good. Yeah, we're proud, not even gonna get
proud
into this.
Nationalism, yikes.
Oh my God, no. Oh, Jesus. Yeah. He's not that kind of white person, guys, I promise.
Thank you. Wow.
he had to go through like a 25-step verification process before he met my cat. Right.
And the cat sealed it.
Yeah. Cute little Dargo.
Yeah. Oh well.
What?
You should explain the name of your cat so that people don't think that's
Dargo?
Yeah.
I think, you know what, anyone who thinks, we're going to make it a fun guessing game. Whoever can figure out, because I think it's pretty obvious, but at the same time, I don't know. It is a horror adjacent name.
It's horror adjacent? Okay.
Yeah, and it is.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Is it Donnie Darko?
Duh. Wow. Where else does that come from?
Okay, good.
Okay. Anyway, okay, sorry. Nosferatu. So yeah, so they hired the dude, Henry Galin, and so they were just like, hey, dude. Adapt Dracula, change around
the
name.
You saw what you did with Gollum.
Gollum was before. Gollum was 1920.
He crushed it with Gollum, y'all.
Change all of the names. So Dracula became Nosferatu. They got rid of Van Helsing. And instead of the plague, they added the plague being sent in by ships. That was one of the things.
A plague being sent in by ships, yeah. As opposed to the plague being there.
I think something else happens in Dracula.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's pretty much like the whole plot.
It's just like Dracula with some... Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why this is all interesting... So they made the film, whatever. It was kind of a hit.
Yeah.
But the thing that happened is...
Dracula was like, what the fuck?
Specifically...
This is my story.
Specifically, Stoker's heirs. So Stoker's heirs, you know, they were like...
Snap.
Bro, what's going on? And they sued him. And that... studio went under immediately.
Ooh.
And
stroked by the Stoke.
Stoke.
Stoke. Get stroked.
No, Stoke. Stoke. Bram Stoker. Okay. Bram I do not Stoker. Want people getting on this podcast saying Bram Stoker. Okay. I'm pretty sure that that's like some dirty thing.
Yeah,
and this
that's
is...
got to be a good movie. That's the movie I was renting at Blockbuster, or trying desperately to rent at Blockbuster anyways.
This just went really dark. And this is a horror podcast. Okay. All right. Okay. No. So, yeah. So
they were pissed.
They were, I mean, the consequence of the lawsuit, they had to destroy Nosferatu.
Oh.
So for years, decades, Nosferatu was unfindable. And then sometime in the 70s, someone found a couple of prints.
Uh-huh.
And that's why.
And a print is like
a film print.
Copy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because back then, it's not like digital today where everything is like.
It's in the cloud.
Literally, it's in the cloud. It's on hard drives.
Yeah.
Half of film school. Mm-hmm. It's just professors telling you to buy hard drives after hard drives.
Okay.
That's what it is now. But back then, it was literally celluloid. It was that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So they were able to find a couple of reels somewhere. And that is why we're able to see Nosferatu today. So
do we know who found it? Where they found it?
I'm sure if we did some Googling.
We got to figure that out.
Yeah.
We'll come back with that next time.
Next
Finding
next week.
Nosferatu. You know? I can see
actually,
that show.
It'll be on theme. Anyway, okay, that's spoiling cool. too much. So yeah, so Nosferatu is probably one of the examples that aren't so obviously linked to those five different tenets of German Expressionism, but it is still highly influenced by that, and it's still considered a German Expressionist film. I mean, let's go through it. So number one,
it's a ripoff of Dracula.
I mean, yes. So it does have that gothic dark story theme already. It does have, there are a lot of shadows in the setting, but actually Nosferatu, if you remember, is one of the few German Expressionist films that has a lot of outdoor scenes,
mm-hmm.
like the ship thing and whatnot. So they did do a lot of off the cuff shooting for that.
Gotcha.
I know. So what did you think of Nosferatu in general, though?
Well, let's see. So the copy I watched there was two options on YouTube. There was, and I encourage you to check them out on YouTube because it's free. Or you could buy them, or you know,
it's,
see it in a more legit way.
This is actually legit. I know.
Yeah.
I mean, Clinton's not wrong, but I mean, if you want to be legit about this, if you have a library card for most major cities, there is a really cool streaming service called Canopy. DC Library offers it. If you're a Mason student, Mason offers it. If you're a university student in general, I'm pretty sure your university should offer it, and you can find Nosferatu on there.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So that let me tell you, you should, because YouTube has two versions. One is really good quality and I think bad sound. It's like somebody just dubbed over like modern, like quote unquote spooky synth, and not even like fun spooky synth. But and then the other one was worse quality, and there's a cat. The cat's behind me. I'm getting a signal. What should I do with the cat?
No, nothing. I just thought it was funny.
Oh, okay, sorry. Where was I? Oh, right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
the other one was good quality.
Right.
Good quality bad music or bad quality good music. So
okay.
The takeaway for me was,
so the
why aren't
just...
I on Canopy? Which I just found out about today, which I am going to download.
Yeah. DC Library limits you to like 6 movies a month.
Okay.
If you're a university student, it's unlimited.
Okay.
So maybe you should just go back to school.
Yeah, I'm going back.
Okay. Anyway, so.
Here's what I thought. The guy looks spooky. Okay.
Okay.
He's making a lot of spooky appearances.
Okay.
I like it. I'm like, yeah, this is old. This is creepy. And. Yeah, and I'm like, what are people saying in the YouTube comments?
What did they say?
Well, they got a good joke, but I'll wait. I'm going to wait for it.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
We'll wait for it.
Okay.
All right, yeah. Nosferatu, and actually Nosferatu is sadly one of the examples of anti-Semitism. A lot of people think Nosferatu is symbolic of... Because, as we know, they completely kind of remade his physical makeup.
He's
so
not as sexy as
he's no Bela Lugosi.
Or at least
all right, Bela Lugosi was 10 years from then, but still, he's not a sexy vampire. He's definitely a creepy vampire.
Which might be sexy for you. We're not here to kink shame.
Actually, yes, I'm sorry. If, you know...
Creepy can be sexy. But he's not... But let's just say. Let's just generally...
You know what? Yeah, Gollum. I forgot that the creepy dude from Lord of the Rings is Gollum, right? But
are we talking about...
G-O-L-L-U-M, right?
That's, I think that's correct.
Okay.
Are you entering him into the debate
of
who's sexier?
Well, I think, to me, He looks like Gollum, like G-O-L-L-U-M.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not like the hotter Gollum, which is G-O-L-E-M.
Gollum definitely, you know.
He could pick you up.
I hope we have a German viewer that, like, hears this and is like, you guys just
yeah, mess it all up. It's like, please don't. Okay. Please stop.
All right, yeah. But that's Nosferatu, you know. Definitely very strong in those themes. Definitely an interesting addition into the German expressionism genre, but also kind of one of the biggest failures. But I mean, so
biggest failures in the sense that they had to burn them all.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But I mean, if we think about it, Nosferatu, he didn't exist before this film, and Nosferatu exists today.
You couldn't burn him. He's like a monster that doesn't die.
And it's because of SpongeBob.
And that's yeah, absolutely, partially. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
But now SpongeBob's dead.
I don't think I knew that, but good. No, good.
You know, it just Wait. Came through my Twitter feed. Rest in peace.
Can you not? Okay. All right. I think maybe one more. Do okay. you want to do Metropolis?
Yes.
Okay. Let's do Metropolis. Metropolis is probably one of my favorite films from this era in general, because you can watch Metropolis today and it still looks dope. I still don't understand how it was made.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a post going around, I mean, Tumblr maybe, but Tumblr's like basically dead, but there's a post going around somewhere that shows you how they made one of those scenes.
Really?
Yeah, it's like the whole perspective thing. And they had people walking yeah. behind a cutout kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God. It's pretty cool. Stunning. Though, it's I will say...
probably a tweet, because Twitter's alive and well.
Fritz Lang, though, who directed... So, Metropolis came out in 1927. Fritz Lang directed it. And Fritz Lang, I don't know. Depends. I don't know who I want to be today. I think German. Okay, Fritz Lang directed it. And he is he's probably the most famous German expressionist director. Like, he made the most consistent ones. He made M before that, and M is also great. But Metropolis, really, it was kind of the first, a lot of people consider it the first science fiction film for many different reasons. We can argue that either other way, but it's definitely probably the most influential science fiction film of all time, period, just because of how it's still being referenced today. Metropolis itself, in a really simple way, it's about this dude. His name is Fredder. He is the son of the...
Sounds like a bro.
Fredder?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Fredder or Fedder.
Okay. We're all yeah. right. It's German.
German. Definitely, yeah. Definitely German. And so his dad is the conglomerate of Metropolis, which is like the most advanced city of all time. But there is a really severe wealth and worker gap. And so Fredder falls in love with this like poor woman, Maria, but she's for the workers, for the people.
Hell yeah.
And he's like, no, I must join the workers and the people. And so he goes and does that. Of course, it pisses off his dad. There's a crazy scientist involved that decides to make a robot of Maria to try and turn...
Good idea.
To try and turn the workers against...
Vicious. They're still doing that today.
I told you, it's a very, very relevant message. I mean, this was made back in the 20s, so... It's difficult to say which one is more influential, Caligari and Metropolis, but they're influential in different ways. So, hey, this is not a competition. Room for everyone.
Yeah, I like that. All winners.
Okay, yeah.
Or
so,
they're winners. We're not. Well, I'm a loser.
No, we win because we garner the culture?
Yes.
I don't know. Okay.
I'm there. I'm a winner now.
All right. Okay. So, yeah. So, that is Metropolis. It was written by him and his wife. So, his wife was actually a really popular expressionist writer at the time. Her name is Thea Von Harbo. And so they wrote it together, and it was an adaptation of a novel that she wrote. And her novel is actually a little crazier. So Metropolis is pretty straightforward. It's what we would call tech horror today. Blade Runner and Ex Machina, these like robots revolt kind of movies, really came because of Metropolis. Or if you're a really big Janelle Monáe fan, she basically, like, her first two albums were strictly Metropolis based. But yeah, so she, her...
Can you do you remember any of the songs? Can you do like a quick...
Yeah, so Cold War. I remember the video for Cold War was, I think it's a straight up like homage to Metropolis.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, everyone, look
at... Can you do like a quick lyric from it right now?
Yeah. It is a cold war. You gotta know who you fighting for. It is a cold... You don't remember? Have you ever...
She's good. She's good.
Who's good?
You.
Oh, that's great. I was like, we know Janelle.
We're
going
to do that. That's going to be a reoccurring thing now that I know you can sing.
No. This film was kind of like the crown jewel of the whole movement.
Okay.
So the novel itself actually was crazier than the whole thing.
How was it crazier? Do you know what?
It included magic and Satanism and everything. Oh. But when they were adapting it for the film, they were like, because it's already a 3-hour film.
Right.
They were like, yeah, let's cut out some of these parts.
Yeah. Or maybe just not even make them. Did they make them and cut them out? Or did
I'm pretty sure they didn't make them. Yeah. I think that they wanted
That shit's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like book shit. That's not movie shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think Fritz Lang, that's probably why he was the most famous one. Anyway, okay, so tell me your thoughts on Metropolis.
Well, it's long. Now, this is one that I did see in... I took, like, a film class in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in a dark, you know, classroom and watching this and being like, wow. And I was, like, 21 years old. I was a big idiot, you know. So it was probably the least interesting thing. But I could also respect how the craftsmanship...
Right.
It looks like an epic...
It's still movie. Really still is. I mean I watch Caligari now, and I definitely get like a sense of I love watching it, but Metropolis really, it's one of these things where you just watch it and it's like my mind is blown every single time I see it, just because I can't even imagine it. The bad part about that though is it is such a grand film. It does so many grand things, but you know how now we have movie tricks to kind of make up for that?
Yeah.
Back then they did all of it. So like, there's a scene where the conglomerate dude is flooding and the evil scientist is flooding the entire city. They literally did that. They literally flooded the studio with all of these people. And so a lot of the actors had a lot of bad things to say about shooting this movie. They were like, he tried to kill us. It was horrible. That's my cat, by the way. People just think that we're just popping.
We're just scratching stuff.
No.
We're scratching a scratch board.
And if you hear little clicky clicks, she's eating now. Anyway, okay, sorry.
But we were on a really cool part because
They
almost, he was like literally drowned people almost.
Yeah, no, Fritz Lang was crazy.
People hated him.
Yeah, I think though if you were, I mean, and I'm not excusing this because I actually, actually don't enjoy most of the directors of this period. I do enjoy Lang's films, I will say. But I mean, I think back then, because it was so difficult to make movies, especially Kubrick is one of the most well-known ones, but that dude did like 70 takes for each shot, so I can only imagine
people probably hated him too, huh? Or did they all to a point where everyone has to pretend to like you if you're so big, you know?
I mean, that's why we have the Me Too movement now. No, like,
helpful.
You know,
yeah,
literally,
yeah,
yeah, because
take out the trash, let's go.
See it,
burn it.
Yes.
Let's do it.
But yeah, so Metropolis, it came out, and would you guess that it was popular or unpopular?
I'm gonna go for the unpopular.
Okay.
As you know, many things are.
Any guess
unpopular,
why?
Unpopular, and then you know, blows up later, and everyone's like, "Oh my god, yeah, I always knew that was great." Because I'm a cynical man, and I assume that people are dumb. Not all the time. That's a little much for me, but.
No, people are dumb. Can you guess why they didn't like it?
Well,
like
if
okay,
it was modern, it would be too long.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons. So first off, it was way too long. So all of the films from this period at most average 60 minutes. You know,
that's
Caligari,
right,
I think,
there.
Is like 76. Nosferatu, I think, is like 64. But Metropolis is a whole whopping 228. Let me tell you, if I see a film now that's 2 hours and 28 minutes, I'm mad. Like, if it's not a Harry Potter,
yeah.
Like, why is this movie 2 hours and 20? I'm pretty sure.
Why didn't you just make a TV show?
Literally, though. Oh, my God. So we could kind of get that. But also, the German public weren't that fond of the communist message, because essentially this was kind of one of the only films that kind of had a positive ending. The workers and Freda and Maria went out at the end. But yeah, they weren't really going for the whole communist message. They thought it was weird. I will say, there is one person that really, really liked it. Do you want to guess who?
Janelle Monáe.
Janelle Monáe liked it. I'll give you a hint. It's someone from this time.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Actually, opposite. Hitler.
Oh.
Hitler was such a huge fan of Metropolis that he modeled a lot of the death camps after the monster machine in the film.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no. This is proof that these films had a massive societal impact. We really can't underscore that back then, especially when there was no real entertainment. I mean, when we had the stage plays, there was still art going on, but these films, this was a hot thing. This was the fidget spinners. Are they the hot thing?
They're no longer the hot thing.
Okay, that shows our age. But they were the hot thing then.
Yeah.
Metropolis, even though it was unpopular at the time, it still had really massive ramifications directly. And now it has a lot of influence everywhere. So, I mean, anything with a sci-fi city pretty much sources right from Metropolis. So, I mean, Blade Runner. Frankenstein came out about 10 years later, but they used a lot of imagery from Metropolis in that. Dr. Strangelove came out in the 60s, but it was very influenced by Metropolis. Metropolis was really like the shining jewel, even though it didn't get the reception then. And a few couple years later, Hitler loved Fritz Lang, but Fritz Lang didn't love him. Fritz Lang exiled to America to go make films with F.W. Murnau. He helped advise a lot of Frankenstein.
I mean, it's like, fuck Hitler, you know? Yeah. This is all I can think is just, man, screw that guy. Yeah, you watch a freaking movie and you get inspired to do even worse shit. That's not what horror is about.
Right, yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, they were technically the Nazi Socialist Party, right? Something like that.
Yeah.
So I guess no one here is defending Hitler. Fuck Hitler for sure. But you can kind of see where a movie like Metropolis really feeds that whole someone with a disease psyche
kind of, because when I see
it's a even dystopian
a, it's a dystopian
yeah.
Okay. Because it looks like the word dystopia, like if I close my eyes and say dystopia,
it's Metropolis.
I'm like picturing Metropolis.
I mean, I'm pretty sure maybe it did invent dystopia, but so I mean, that is a really brief overview of German Expressionism. Those were some of the most important films, some of the most important messages put out to celluloid. And then what happened? So around 1933, the films started to stop because of the rise of the Nazi Party. So a majority of everyone fled to America or to other parts of Europe. Some did stay, like the director for Golem stayed. But he stayed and worked as a Nazi actor, actually.
Really?
But the interesting part about that is he was actually safe haven for Nazi victims. So he...
His like, place was?
Yeah, his place was. So he set up a bunker to help protect... Yeah, so he technically worked for the dudes, but he also saved a lot of people.
Okay.
So, you know, it definitely had an effect on the society, for sure, of Germany. But if anything, it really had almost more of an effect on the international community, because then what happened is all of those directors, those writers, they moved to America. And what began, so this was about early 1930, and so what happened in the early 1930s in America, what was going on historically
in the 1930s in America?
Yeah,
the Great Depression.
Exactly. Exactly. And as we said, films are a reflection of society's
anxieties, of our depressed Yeah.
So you have these really skilled directors that have all of these new ideas and things like that. You have these American writers and directors, and you have these studios being like, what's the next big thing?
Yeah.
The next big thing are the monster movies. Woo! The pre-code horror films. Yeah. Frankenstein and Dracula actually came out in the same year, 1931. Okay. And the really interesting thing about the 30s in America is we didn't really have a rating system in America. So there was no MPAA. And in the 20s in America, everyone was making a film about like rape and drugs and everything. They weren't really horror films.
I haven't seen those Disney movies.
Actually, no. The Disney films from around that time were just straight up racism.
Oh, yes, true.
Yes.
Sadly true.
Yeah, very, very sadly true. They
were going wild.
They were going really wild.
They were like...
There were no rules.
Yeah.
But this dude, his name is William Hayes, in the 30s, he started something called the Production Code. And it was spearheaded by the Catholics and Protestant movements in America. And he was a legislator, and he was like, yo, you know what we're going to do? No sex, no drugs, no blasphemy, no say. They really wanted to completely cleanse movies of anything that wasn't proper.
Yeah,
But the interest.
But did he hide it under like, we're gonna rate them? You know, like, oh, this is, you know, don't worry about it. You'll just be rated, you know, W, and then
That's a great question. It was actually more extreme.
Okay,
films would be straight up banned. So it's not like now that we have these ratings and you can technically see like an NC-17 movie.
Yeah.
And no, it was more like your film won't be screened.
Gotcha.
You know?
Was this under like a religious?
It was mainly speared by religion. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Because they were, and again, this is where it gets a bit anti-Semitic. The moguls in Hollywood were Jewish. That was just a straight up fact. They were the ones really running the industry back then in the 20s. And so, yeah, these Catholics and these Protestants were like, no, we need to Christianize this. We need to make America great again.
Because we know the Bible doesn't have any of these naughty bits in it.
So, yeah, so William Hayes created it in 1930. But what was happening? So these German directors got here, and now they're like, okay, we're going to make crazy films. But this production code is rising. But the problem was the production code was enforced state by state. So it was kind of like a same-sex marriage kind of thing, you know, where like it was super conservative in Montana, but it wasn't that strictly enforced in New York or anything. So the really interesting thing, and again, this is where archiving history around this time period gets really kind of fuzzy, is that between 1930 and 1934, the horror genre really rose. So you had Universal Pictures, you know, really pushing Frankenstein, and there were like about 7 different Frankensteins. You had a lot of different Draculas, you had vampires, werewolves, you had everything. And these German directors really took advantage of that. And this was also really the start of film noir. So do you know any film noir films?
I don't know. What are some film noir films?
A lot of like Humphrey Bogart, you know, black and white gangster kind of things. A lot of Hitchcock films are considered film noir. Black and white, deep shadows. They didn't exaggerate set as intensely as the Germans did, but you can definitely see a watering down of all of these ideas, these really dark themes and things like that. But especially between 1930 and 1934, you really had the chance to do anything. And people, they knew that the production code was going to be enforced a lot stricter soon. So they just started making films and making films and making films. And these films were crazy. Like, you have Island of Lost Souls. I think Island of Lost Souls. I already forgot the name. Island of Lost Souls, which was about bestiality, basically. You had Dr. X, which was about cannibal murders and performing science experiments. We had Frankenstein. We had Dracula being released in this time. And then the film, the pre-code era in America kind of ended around 1934. And one of the last films was The Black Cat, which was Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff, which are like the two horror greats of that time. And it was specifically about war, the ramifications of World War I. And it was about a dude seeking revenge on another dude who stole his wife, killed her, then married his daughter. And
oof.
Yeah, no. So I mean, these pre-code horror films are crazy. And that film actually was directed. He was a German expressionist writer. And it was his only American film. It was his only film he ever directed, because about 2 weeks later. So in 1934, what happened is the production code went national. And it got very strict. And it would stay very strict until around the 60s is when production code was lifted. So that was really the most direct effect.
What were you going to say about it was his last? It sounded like it was his last movie he ever.
Yeah, it was his last. I'm pretty sure it was his last film. It was definitely his last American film.
Yeah.
One, because the reception was pretty wild.
People were like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah, gross. But it was actually the highest grossing film of that year. And Karloff, it was the first film between Karloff and Lugosi, and they ended up making like 10 films after that. They were considered the great duo, even though they hated each other. I just learned that the other day. I know, which is kind of crazy.
It's like us.
No. And so, yeah. So that was this pretty much German Expressionism, Rise and Fall. And then, like I said, some of the directors had, F.W. Murnau is, I think, probably most well known for Sunrise. But I mean, Nosferatu is still a classic today. I mean, Nosferatu is Nosferatu.
Real quick.
Right.
Do the listeners have to see the first one before they see Nosferatu?
The first Nosferatu?
Right. So can they just watch Nosferatu, or do should
okay,
they
that was a horrible joke. We're moving on.
That joke comes to you from YouTube commenter Christopher McIntyre. Christopher McIntyre, thank you for leaving a YouTube comment that's funny and not racist.
Oh man, actually that's a good idea. Thank you. Actually, I was about to get sassy, but I'm glad that wasn't racist. Let's clap for no racism.
Just funny jokes. That's what we're looking for on our online experience. Like,
yeah. All right. Okay. So, what do you think about German Expressionism? Let's.
I feel like I have knowledge now. I feel like I want to go back and watch these movies again. Yeah, and there's a lot to take away. And right. I love how it fits into the history, which I also don't know that much about. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Learning history through films.
That's right. I'm excited to keep learning. What are we going to be learning about next?
All right. Well, you know, with this podcast, we definitely want to look at film movements through the international lens. So like German Expressionism or Japanese horror, we'll probably do one day. We also want to go ahead and analyze really common horror tropes through the foreign lens. So our next one will be foreign vampires.
I'm not going to do the sounds.
Yeah, no. So we'll go ahead and look at the
vampires. Or be live. But they probably have different accents.
They actually don't.
And I'm not going to do them.
Okay. Yeah. We'll wait for the next episode. So yeah, so we'll go ahead and look at the vampire trope through the lens of different horror films. And we'll talk about, I mean, the vampire itself is a foreign, you know.
It's a foreign word, right?
I mean, it's a foreign character, because I think the very first lore does go direct from Romania, right, or at least Dracula,
right.
And everything we know, even Nosferatu, is sourced from Dracula, because there's also the lesbian vampire movement.
Oh, yeah, we are getting into that, ladies and gentlemen.
Don't be a creep.
I'm not a creep.
Calm down.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Let me get equally excited about the next thing you say.
No, we're not going there.
Okay.
So we hope that you enjoyed this episode.
That you enjoyed this episode a lot.
I've had a wonderful time with my colleague, Mr. Clinton.
Thank you. I've had a great time with my colleague, May.
Yes.
And the host of the show.
All right. And we hope to see you next time. Be safe out there. Goodbye.
Bye.